The headlines: Russia says the U.S. must withdraw its nuclear weapons from non-nuclear countries and eliminate the infrastructure for their deployments in Europe. Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes a hearing on the dismissal of a no-confidence vote against Prime Minister Imran Khan and the dissolution of Parliament. And China's most populous city, Shanghai, extends its COVID restrictions after a new surge in daily cases. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia is critical of the U.S. deploying atomic weapons in non-nuclear NATO states, insisting that they must be eliminated from Europe. Deputy U.N. Representative Dmitry Polyansky says Washington is violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He says U.S. non-strategic atomic weapons are kept in non-nuclear European countries. Adding such weapons and their delivery means are even being modernized. Speaking at a meeting of the U.N. Disarmament Commission, Polyansky also criticized the involvement of NATO's non-nuclear members in nuclear weapons training under joint missions. He rejected the idea of Russia using nukes in the Ukraine conflict, saying Moscow would only use its nuclear potential in response to similar attacks against Russia or its allies. Russia and the U.S. possess around 90% of the world's atomic weapons. We've talked to historian and author Marcus Papadopoulos. Here is his take on why Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe.
It is my submission that the reason why the Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe is to ensure that America remains politically, economically, and militarily in Europe, and that Europe continues to remain in the stranglehold of Washington's. Indeed, we can say the same about NATO. The very reason that NATO was established in the first place was to keep the Americans in Europe, the Germans down in Europe, and the Russians out of Europe. Despite how destabilizing American nuclear weapons are in Europe, the Americans nonetheless will continue to keep them there because, as I said moments ago, it is a way of preserving American influence and power in Europe.
This day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here is a quick rundown of the theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in a shift toward the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say that Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations there. Moscow says its drawdown near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say that Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kyiv. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team has not been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. The diplomatic fallout over the newly discovered mass graves in Ukraine is deepening, with several European countries moving to ban Russian diplomats. Denmark says it will expel 15 diplomatic staff over what the country's foreign minister called apparent war crimes in Ukraine's Bucha. Italy also says it has expelled 30 Russian diplomats on security grounds. Earlier, France, Germany, and Lithuania announced similar measures. All of them have cited the alleged massacre of civilians. Russia, on the other hand, is denying reports of killing civilians in northern Ukraine. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is calling the Western accusations false. The foreign ministry has also warned that it will retaliate against the expulsion of its diplomats. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Western countries' accusation that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine is in line with their attempts to create a propaganda campaign against Moscow.
They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And, of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not.
Moving on, Pakistan's Supreme Court resumes its deliberations on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve parliament to avert a no-confidence vote was legal. Khan lost his parliamentary majority last week, facing a no-confidence motion. Speculations of the Prime Minister losing the vote had been running rife, but the Deputy Speaker blocked a debate on the motion on Sunday, triggering a full-blown political drama. The crisis deepened after Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly and call a snap election. A united opposition is calling that decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has been dissolved as well in anticipation of fresh elections. The prime minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and cracking down on corruption, but Khan blames foreign conspiracy and says opposition figures have colluded with the U.S. to topple him. Washington says it has nothing to do with the current turmoil in Pakistan. For the first time, chants of death to America were heard in Pakistan's parliament after a no-confidence vote against Prime Minister Imran Khan was dismissed as unconstitutional. Khan says the motion was a U.S. plot to oust him. Hashtag Trending takes a review of social media reactions to the story.
What's going on, everyone? Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. The situation has been tense in Pakistan since past week amid a political crisis which involves a face-off between a coalition of opposition groups and the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan. The opposition was preparing for a no-confidence vote on Imran Khan's cabinet, hoping to oust him through parliamentary vote. But the tide has turned as the deputy parliament speaker has declared the vote unconstitutional and part of a plot by foreign powers to interfere in Pakistan's democracy. The developments in the parliament led to a historic moment when, for the first time, some lawmakers chanted anti-US slogans, and now some people on social media are saying that the no-confidence vote was a coup attempt plotted by Washington, and its failure shows that the days of the American empire in Pakistan are over. Our first tweet comes from Sharmeen Narwani. The president of Pakistan dissolves the National Assembly before a no-confidence vote on Imran Khan, pushed by pro-US MPs or members of parliament. Chants of death to America heard in Pakistan's parliament for the first time. Washington again picked the wrong battle. Welcome to the resistance, Pakistan. Pierre F. Lerisson says, U.S. coup failure in Pakistan is a sign that empire's days as hegemon are over. For the first time in the history of Pakistan's parliament, its members chanted death to America as they rejected a no-confidence vote which sought to oust Prime Minister Khan. Garikai Chengu says, death to America now echoes in Pakistan's parliament. Saudi Arabia no longer answers Biden's calls. Biden begs Venezuela for oil. Russia sparks a wave of energy deals in rupees, yuan, and ruble. The American empire's foundations are crumbling. After the no-confidence vote was dismissed, the president dissolved the National Assembly on Imran Khan's advice. This means that Pakistan must now hold snap elections within 90 days to vote for a new parliament to form a new cabinet. Our next batch of comments starts with one by Sana Sara. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan calls new elections after parliament cancelled a no-confidence vote against him. Over here we have a comment by Hamad Ahmed. He has plans for Pakistan. Free him from a hung parliament. Give him freedom and power to work and see where he takes Pakistan. News channels show one side of him. The real IK, Imran Khan, is not about power, but people. Benjamin Norton has this tweet. The US-backed coup attempt against Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has failed for now. The president dissolved the National Assembly, meaning new elections must be held within 90 days. But it seems Khan lost the military support, so it's dangerous. Uzair Kazmi tweeted, I was just thinking that in a parliament of around 340 members, only 153 cared about Pakistan. More than 50% of our parliament is ready to sell this country for money. Back to the studio for the rest of the world's news.
Suffering at its peak in Afghanistan, a new study shows that almost all Afghan people consider their living conditions to be so dismal to characterize as suffering. According to the Gallup survey, 94% of Afghans have rated their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. This is the highest level measured for any country since 2005. The study shows that the percentage of women suffering is higher than men, and that women are more pessimistic about their futures. With the entire world now focusing on the conflict in Ukraine, Afghanistan has been deprived of the attention and the humanitarian assistance that it much deserves. The situation has become even worse since the Taliban takeover last year, with the world refusing to recognize the Taliban government and the United States freezing billions of dollars worth of Afghan assets. Humanitarian aid to the country has almost entirely dried up. Officials in China's largest city and economic hub, Shanghai, are extending restrictions on transportation amid a surge in COVID cases. The restrictions will see more transportation networks, including subway lines, suspended. The entire population under lockdown was tested for Omicron on Monday. The mass testing raised the number of asymptomatic infections by almost 25% to over 13,000. Officials have also extended the lockdown to Shanghai's western parts. That means that more than 25 million residents will be under restriction until further notice. Tens of thousands of medical and military personnel are overseeing the operation. South Korean farmers and fishers have protested against the government's plan to enter into another free trade deal, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. They say the further opening of their industry to cheaper goods from abroad will destroy their livelihoods. Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
Hundreds of South Korean farmers and fishers protested in the country's financial and political center, Yoido, demanding the government reconsider its intention to enter into yet another free trade agreement. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, will follow in the footsteps of previous rounds of deals. The critics argue usher in cheap foreign goods and jeopardize domestic producers.
In the past, during the Uruguay round, the government made fun of the farmers once, and then during the South Korea-US and South Korea-China FTAs, they deceived our farmers a second time. With the indoctrination of the CPTPP, we are about to be deceived a third time. Should we be deceived?
The 11-member CPTPP includes Vietnam, Australia, Japan, Canada, and Mexico. South Korea only a month ago joined a 15-member trade bloc led by China, as Seoul moves to open 90% of the country's agricultural market. Farmers and fishers demand consultation.
When the government tries to introduce this type of thing, it has to have some policies prepared. Discussing with farmers to some extent, and there should be some hope for agriculture and rural areas. But I don't think it should be pushed unilaterally like this.
Proponents say South Korea's high-tech export-led model needs all the help it can get, with the CPTPP deal set to boost the country's GDP by one-third of 1%. South Korea's own Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy recognizes the negative impact such free trade deals have on those gathered here outside the country's National Assembly. With a corporate-friendly conservative president set to take office here in May, these farmers' concerns over their livelihoods will only grow. Frank Smith, Seoul.
North Korea warns that it will attack Seoul with nuclear weapons if it chooses military confrontation or makes a preemptive strike on Pyongyang. The warning came from Kim Yo-jong, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. On Friday, South Korea's defense minister said that Seoul had accurate missiles, which could, quote, quickly hit any target in North Korea. Kim said it was a very big mistake for the South Korean minister to talk about an attack on the North. However, she added that Pyongyang opposes war and does not view South Korea as its principal enemy. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula since last month, when the North resumed testing intercontinental ballistic missiles after a five-year pause. Writer and political commentator Brian Berletech has shared his thoughts with us on North Korea's latest threat to use nuclear weapons against the South.
The nuclear threat came after these very needlessly reckless comments coming from South Korea. People have to remember that there are some about 20,000 U.S. troops in South Korea that the U.S. has for decades designated the Korean Peninsula as one of its principal fronts to encircle and contain China. And they have maintained this environment of belligerence toward the North all of these decades. And the threat is real. The U.S. has carried out serial wars of aggression around the globe, and they are sitting there right on North Korea's border. So I think North Korea's perception of a threat is legitimate, and I think their comments were very measured. They were threatened first by South Korea, and they responded by saying there will be retaliation, but we do not see South Korea as a threat, as an enemy, or as an enemy. So I think this all could have been avoided if South Korea would just focus on coexistence and moving forward together with the North rather than this needless saber rattling.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty moral tips for the challenging journey to God, selected from statements made by the leader of the revolution. The first and foremost step in self-edification is that one should look at themselves and their behavior and manners with a critical eye. They should clearly and carefully observe their shortcomings and try to correct them. This can be done by us, and this responsibility is upon us. Between you and God, one of the most important characteristics in self-edification, and probably the first priority, is sincerity. It means being sincere in doing something and not acting deceitfully. Sincerity in worshiping God and doing good deeds means doing it only for the sake of God. It is unfortunately common among people to talk about their good deeds as if they are not aware that good deeds should not be bragged about. There are, of course, exceptions. Some deeds should be done publicly. For example, donating in public is valued differently in hadith than donating secretly. Another example is congregational prayers, which are done in public, and it is part of the divine orders. But many or most prayers, those between an individual and God, such as reciting, remembering God in dhikr prayers, spending nights and praying and helping others, should stay between the individual and God.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Be our own therapist. Be your own therapist. The best one to distinguish our shortcomings is us. Write them down: jealousy, stinginess, malevolence. Write down that when someone achieves something, it upsets us. Write about your sluggishness when working. Write about your pessimism about good and righteous people, negligence of responsibilities, egocentricity. We are so self-absorbed. The month of Ramadan is a great opportunity to treat these maladies as much as possible. You will become of steely if, in the first place, a young student should engage in self-edification, build their characters through religious training. Education, educators, and educational speakers are all needed. But if there is not an inner mentor to train and educate you, such training will not be effective. Build your characters and fight your ego. Value obeying God's commands in your personal lives and engage in prayer, attention to God, and relying on God. This will make you as strong as steel.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Turkish prosecutor has requested to halt the trial for Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul and transfer it to Saudi Arabia, some 4 years after the dissident Saudi journalist was murdered in Turkey. The court requested the Justice Ministry's opinion on the issue and is expected to rule on the request at its next hearing, set for April 7th. The Saudi Chief Public Prosecutor's Office had requested the transfer, and evidently the Turkish courts are planning to comply. Turkey's justice minister said earlier that his ministry would approve a request to transfer a trial over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have condemned the move, saying Riyadh cannot be expected to hold a fair trial for the alleged killers of the journalist. In 2020, Saudi Arabia jailed 8 people for between 7 and 20 years for Khashoggi's murder. None of the defendants was named in what rights groups described as a sham trial. Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. A U.S. intelligence report released a year ago said Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had approved the operation to kill Khashoggi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the murder had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, an accusation that has already strained the relations between the two countries and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish goods, which cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. The request by the Turkish prosecutor comes as Turkey seeks to mend ties with Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis absolutely have both an economic and a political interest in further ties to Turkey and Erdogan. I think it is a relationship where both of them are looking to get out of their tough situations, both politically and economically. There is political devastation and economic devastation, specifically in Turkey, and there is an economic, clear economic interest to Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia and various other figures in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey to increase these ties that are beneficial for the United States and for other Western vassal states in the Middle East.
Turkish-Saudi relations have remained strained since Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. With the announcement that Turkish courts will no longer seek to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable, it seems clear that Erdogan has decided to prioritize his political future over the pursuit of justice in the Khashoggi killing. In recent months, Erdogan has spoken of improving ties with Saudi Arabia, hoping that better relations will help Turkey recover from an economic crisis that has left it struggling with 50% inflation. He apparently is hoping to attract financial support and investment from Saudi Arabia as well as the UAE for Turkey's inflation-ravaged economy. Turkish and Emirati leaders recently visited each other's capitals, ending a decade of hostility culminating in Abu Dhabi's announcement that it intended to make $10 billion in new investments in Turkey. In addition to his efforts to improve ties with the Saudis and Emiratis, Erdogan has also looked to improve relations with Israel. The recent visit to Ankara by Israeli President Isaac Herzog signals a reset in Erdogan's stance.
Turkey is trying to view a new balance of power in the Middle East and in relations with all the countries around them. Turkey has always, when it comes to global geopolitics, tried to play both sides. They've been on both sides where they have economic ties in Russia, economic ties and political ties to the United States. And in the Middle East, there has always been a complicated nature of Turkey's relationship to Islamist groups throughout the Middle East, and that entire situation has showed that Turkey doesn't maybe necessarily want to be in the middle ground any longer. And it seems that in this era of rising tensions and changing relations, Erdogan and Turkey is trying to position themselves in a possible place where Western ties and economic benefits shift the balance of power in the region.
Given the emerging degree of cooperation between Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the US, Erdogan's recent efforts to pursue closer ties with each of these countries may reflect not only his interest in winning foreign investment, but his strategic calculation about the future balance of power in the region.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. That's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with the country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the U.S. takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massey agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massey says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know? And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely.
The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
And I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by British royal family for centuries,
when William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network, calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized a slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام الغنى والفقر بعد العرض على الله.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated, Riches and destitution will follow presentation before Allah.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Imam Ali's beautiful persona is truly universal, and this is because Imam Ali's behaviors, his morals, his characteristics, his persona is something which can be taken advantage of and is beneficial to all people throughout time. Even though Imam Ali lived well over 1,000 years ago, we find that his statements are very much applicable even to today's time. Now, there have been many philosophers and many thinkers across time and history, but we find that this quality of permanence and being everlasting is primarily found in the teachings of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, the teachings of the divinely appointed Imams, and the teachings of divinely appointed messengers. And this is because they are connected to the source of time, knowledge, and wisdom, that is the Almighty Allah. In one instance, we find that Imam Ali says, "O human beings, if you extend your hand in need towards a person, you will become certainly his captive." It's very interesting in today's day and age when we live beyond our means, and when we live not according to what our income is, we end up running into the trouble of not having enough money. We don't have enough financial standing in order to be able to afford all of these things, which of course are not within our means. This pushes us towards debt. And when we start to go towards debt, then we are forced to extend our hand in need towards another person. We find in the modern age this is done through loans, through banks. And these loans are what? They are this promise that you will pay back the individual. Now, what happens when you extend your hand in need towards a person or a bank in this case? Why are we extending our hand in need? Because we decided to not live within our means. Then they give you a loan, and what happens? Imam Ali says, you will certainly become their captive. Dear brothers and sisters, is this not what we see in the world today? It is known as debt slavery. Masses and countless numbers of people who have become captives. They have become slaves because they extended their hand in need towards individuals who were waiting to take advantage of them. Now, of course, if we are in serious need and we tried our best to be able to live within our means, and we still tried our best to make ends meet and go out there and work and earn that income and earn our livelihood, but we weren't able to, then of course we ask people who are trustworthy to help us out. And in the end, perhaps even in the beginning, it is more appropriate that we ask the Almighty Allah and then strive to do something about our livelihood. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiyya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, those people who have carefully studied the conditions of life and the world pass their days as if they know that they are travelers who have to leave a place which is famine-stricken, unhealthy, and uncongenial, and they have to proceed towards lands which are fertile, congenial, and where there is abundant provision of all comforts and pleasures. They have eagerly taken up the journey, happy in the hope of future blessings and peace. They have willingly accepted the sufferings, troubles, and hazards of the way, parting of friends, scarcity of food and comfort during the pilgrimage, so that they may reach the journey's end, a happy place. They do not refuse to bear any discomfort and do not grudge any expenditure by way of giving out alms and charities and helping the poor and the needy. Every step which they put forward towards their goal, however tiring and exhausting it may be, is a happy event of their lives. On the contrary, the condition of those people who are solely engrossed in this world and are sadly engulfed in its short-lived, quickly fading and vicious pleasures is like that of travelers who are staying in fertile and happy regions and who have to undertake a journey knowing fully well that the journey is going to end in a rough, arid, and infertile land.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
As a narration going back to Asba bin Nubata, one of his very close companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, where he talks about the very first, the very earliest speech that Amir al-Mu'mineen gave when the Ummah came to him and accepted him as their leader and Khalifa. And he says, you know, Ali basically came into the masjid